Here we are. So this is October 3rd, and and so we are still talking about, let's see, we got 2, 4, 6, 8, and 3 is 11, 12, 13. It looks like we have 13, Patty. I don't know if you, okay. And then you can kind of keep track of who comes in. So we're still talking about the background to pragmatism. Remember, I have kept on contending that pragmatism grew up in a positivistic milieu, as it were. And by positivism, I mean, and it's positivism, of course, is this sort of ultra-scientific worldview where if it's not scientific, it's not knowledge, right? And knowledge has got to be, it's got to meet some sort of standard of science. It doesn't have to be all mathematical like Newton did with mechanics. It doesn't have to be that rigorous, maybe. But it's got to meet certain standards before we're going to call it science. And we're not going to call something knowledge unless we can call it science. And then, conversely, if we can't call it science, then it's we're just wasting our time. We may be speculating here and there and making up stuff, but you might as well spend your time, you know, doing something else that's more constructive. That's the attitude of the positivists. Right? I told you the story that when I was in college, and I think it was my junior year in college, and I encountered A.J. Ayer's Language, Truth, and Logic, which was the English language manifesto of the Vienna Circle, the logical positivist school of the 1930s. And I was just swept off my feet by it because everything was just so clear and black and white and all that sort of thing. Well, life is a little more muddy than that. But to a junior in college, it's kind of neat, you know? That's the attitude. And I'll bet you my bottom dollar that probably at least half the people at Ollie, whether they know it or not, are positivists. Don't you bet?
Yeah.
Because they're all really impressed with science. And they, for them, science is the beginning and the end, and that's basically the positivistic outlook, to put it really crudely. So what I'm doing is I'm just going through and exploring the background to positivism. And the positivists have always regarded Hume and Kant as being sort of the grandparents of that movement. So my standard diagram, of course, is this circle. And the circle represents what's knowledge, and therefore what's scientific, since the two are the same. So I went through Hume. I finished that last week. And for Hume, there are three criteria, any one of which, if a proposition meets, it is bona fide scientific knowledge. But if a proposition doesn't meet any of the three criteria, then it's not. The three criteria, once again, they're over here, and they're abbreviated. I pie-sliced my circle here. relations of ideas. Standard example, a bachelor is unmarried, right? I mean, you analyze the concept bachelor, you find unmarriedness in there, and you know, because you understand the language, you know that proposition is true. And conversely, a bachelor is married. There's a bachelor is married. Well, that can't possibly be the case, because I know that bachelors are unmarried. Okay. Matters of fact, those are standard empirical questions, standard empirical propositions. My example was all bachelors are less than 100 years old. Well, there's no way you can figure whether that's true or not just by thinking about the words, but we all know what we would do to verify or falsify that. We go out and look, and we'd examine, we'd survey all the bachelors over 100 years old, male, adult male humans over 100 years old, and see if they were all unmarried. And if so, then that's a true proposition. Otherwise, it's false. So that's pretty clear. The one that Hume is not at all clear on, but we are fairly clear on it, I think, and that's that third criterion, which is developed in the context of Hume's exploration of causation. And of course, remember, he asks himself the question, how do I know that the future will resemble the past? That's what a cause implies, that the future will resemble the past. Well, how do I know that? And he says, in brief, that, well, it's not a relation of ideas, nor is it a matter of fact. I don't know it. I mean, in, at least I don't know it intellectually. And good morning. Well, and you know, it's of course it's very easy. It's very easy to misunderstand what Hume is saying there, because, and of course, as I keep on telling people, I wrote I don't know if you've read the email I sent out yesterday on Kant, but I was talking about how all philosophers have their foibles, you know, and Hume's foible, well, Kant's foible, everybody drives everybody crazy, is he over-systematizes everything. I mean, you can't encounter a paragraph in Kant where he's not bringing out, well, this is the material and this is the formal, or this is the this and this is the that kind of thing, and there can only be 12 of these, not 11, not 13, and all that sort of thing. Well, Hume's foible is that he was a bit vain, and he was a bit vain about his cleverness, because he is a clever guy, and he knew that he was smarter than everybody else around, and he sort of enjoys shocking his readers. And this is the problem in understanding Hume, because when Hume says, in so many words, when he says that the expectation that the future will resemble the past is not rational, it's easy to misinterpret that as saying, you have no basis for expecting the future to resemble the past. Why don't you give that up? We shouldn't expect the future to resemble the past. Hume is not saying that at all. He's not saying we shouldn't, nor is he saying that the future won't resemble the past. He's saying the basis of it, the origin of that expectation, is not in your cerebral cortex. It's down in the brainstem somewhere. I mean, that's the way I'm putting it. He didn't put it that way, but you know. The reason of animals. He talks about the reason of animals. Animals expect the future to resemble the past, too. Good morning. And so, but animals don't have any relations of ideas, or they don't examine empirical data the way we do, but they do expect the future to resemble the past. That means that there's something really deep there in that neural structure of ours that forces us, in fact, and as we would say nowadays, you know, it's a biological inheritance. It's part of our genetic makeup that we expect that, and that's where it comes from. So even though Hume himself wasn't, because he's a pioneer. So he's pioneers often don't understand what they're pioneering. 200 years later, you can look back on it and say, oh, yeah, you were pioneering X.
John Wesley didn't.
Yeah, right. So, in a way, yeah, that's right.
Nor Jesus.
I was going to say, that's what I was about to say. So we can excuse David Hume for not understanding what he was pioneering. And but looking back on it, really what he's saying is this, and to put it in just a nutshell, this is a 21st century retrospective on what he was saying. There are three criteria for, I'm talking about positivism, for those of you who came in late. Positivism is the idea that is going to undergird the pragmatic school, and it's the idea that if something is knowable, it's knowable scientifically, and conversely, if it's not knowable scientifically, you're wasting your time. It's not knowable, period. And we're talking about Hume and Kant for that purpose. These three criteria, as a 21st century person, I can look back on it and I can say, well, really what he's getting at are three things that will that are touchstones for something's being knowledge. The first one is language, right? The relations of ideas. A bachelor is unmarried. We know that's true because we understand the English language. You know, it's linguistically verified, maybe you might want to say. I don't know. The matters of fact are your standard empirical propositions. We verify or falsify them by going out and looking at the world. And then the third one that he can't even come up with a consistent terminology. He's got like five terms to refer to it here and there. And I've been using the word instinct because I think that's the best of the lot. But that's biological. It's just part of our genetic inheritance. So, you know, language, observation, and then our biology are three sources of knowledge. And if something, and then if a proposition is not, does not fall under any of those three, you know, you have three chances here, three tests you can apply, and if it does not fall under any one of the three, it's not knowable. Once again, I'll go back to Tom's question that you asked like 2 weeks ago, or whatever it's been. And when Tom said, well, does this exclude ethics, for example? It seems awfully restrictive, he says. It would exclude ethics. My answer is, well, it depends on whom you're talking about. If you're talking about the logical positivist, yes, it does exclude ethics. Charles Stevenson wrote a book called Ethics and Language, where he was developed the positivistic theory of ethics, which is the emotivist theory of ethics, which is saying that ethical propositions are nothing but emotive interjections. They're emotive expostulations. When I say that murder is wrong, it's like just saying, you know, murder, boo, or something like that. The grammar of it is misleading because it sounds like it's the kind of thing that can be true or false. If I say murder is wrong, well, that's like X is A, so it sounds like something can be true or false. But really, a deep analysis of it reveals that it's not something that can be true or false. It's just an expression of an attitude. There are real problems with that, of course, because we try to convince one another that they're wrong if we disagree morally. And we think we can argue about those kind of things. But if Stevenson's right, all we can do is just, you know, I guess abuse the opposition or badger them as much as we possibly can. And whatever, you know, rational discourse is, unless they're foolish enough never to have read my book and think that moral propositions really have content. But if they've read my book, then all we can do is just, whoever talks loudest and most emotionally wins the argument, something like that. Well, anyway,
there's
yes, John.
A utilitarian part of that, though, because society hangs together better and progresses if you obey moral.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Still doesn't fit.
Well, but still, the point. I mean, really, it's a. I guess you might say a linguistic analysis of what ethical propositions are. And, he literally is saying that if I say murder is wrong, that's like saying murder, boo,
well, John,
or something like that.
Better than progressive. See, those are already biased terms.
Yeah, but it hangs together.
But not matters of fact.
Yeah, but it hangs together.
Yeah, that may in fact be true as a sociological observation. If we all agree that murder is wrong, if we all agree murder, boo, then it makes things work better. Yeah, as a sociological observation, maybe so. But the point is,
all right, I'm speaking more generally of moral principles.
Yeah.
You have a fabric, therefore society hangs together.
Yeah. But we're not talking about that. We're saying what are, are we talking science or not when we're talking morals? That's really the question, and the answer is no. Which is the opposite, actually, of utilitarianism. The utilitarian, the inspiration for utilitarianism was to make ethics scientific. That's why Bentham, for example, insists on quantification everywhere, pleasure and pain. Well, we can that's empirical at least, so it's kind of like Newton maybe, and then we look at things that can be quantified: the intensity, the duration, the propinquity, the certainty, and all that sort of stuff, the extent, whatever, all these criteria, they can all be measured, and so we can make ethics scientific. Well, this is just the opposite. This is saying that ethics is, the logical positivist, that is, that ethics is outside the boundary. Now, as I said to Tom, though, other positivists will draw this circle more generously. So Hume and Kant, the great-grandparents of positivism, will draw it in such a way that ethics does fall within the fold. Both of them were moral philosophers also. And then, as we will see when we finally get to William James expands it so much that you begin to wonder what his link to positivism really is, even though historically that's where it grew out from. But because William James, of course, for us, one of the big concerns is not just ethics, but how about religion? Where does religion fall? Well, it's very clear for Hume and Kant that religion falls out here somewhere. I mean, and that last, remember I quoted that last sentence from the Hume's inquiry concerning human understanding. He says, well, all you need to do is take into our hand, he says, if we approach our libraries persuaded of these principles, what havoc must we make? If we take into our hands, for instance, any volume of divinity or school metaphysics, let us ask, does it contain any relations of ideas concerning quantity or number? No. Does it contain any matters of fact concerning, or any propositions concerning matters of fact in existence? No. Commit it then to the flames, for it can contain nothing but sophistry and illusion. That's almost a direct quote of the last paragraph of the first inquiry. What is divinity or school metaphysics, right? We talked about that last week. Divinity is simply an old-fashioned word for theology. School metaphysics, the school part of it, is referring to the scholastics, which, once again, is the group of thinkers in the 13th and 14th and 15th centuries, 16th, 17th centuries, who were sort of half philosophers and half theologians. So basically, religion, for Hume, definitely falls outside the bounds. If you're talking about the existence of God, the immortality of the soul, free will, miracles, all these theological questions, predestination, all this sort of thing, all you're doing is talking. Yeah, just this. That's all you're doing. But there's no substance there. It's just empty wind from Hume's perspective. And by the way, Kant will be similar. But James won't. Yes, go ahead.
How was he accepted at that time in Scotland?
You're talking about for his religious views?
Yeah.
He was not liked very much. As a matter of fact, his most important religious or philosophy of religion work, titled Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, was published posthumously. So that tells you something. And Boswell, Boswell, of Johnson and Boswell fame, was when Hume was on his Hume, I don't know what he died of, maybe cancer, perhaps, I don't know. But when he was on his deathbed, Boswell saw him and said, "Okay, now what do you think?"
Have you changed your mind?
Hume says, "No, I haven't."
This is your last chance.
Yeah. So there you go. I mean, but the 18th century Britain was liberal enough in terms of allowing various points of view to be freely expressed. I mean, he wasn't persecuted or anything like that. But
so Donnelly says he didn't argue that it was wrong. He just said you can't know.
Basically, that's right.
I mean, there is a difference.
Oh yeah, there is a difference.
Obviously. Almost all religions are wrong by definition because they conflict with each other.
Right.
So logically, he could make that argument. That there can only be one of these that's right anyway.
True. That's true.
Most sort of.
Right. All right. Yeah. No. I mean, strictly speaking. Now, when you read especially the inquiry concerning human understanding, he was a little bolder in that than he was in the much earlier treatise. But he has a chapter. He has a chapter on free will, he has a chapter on the existence of God, and he has a chapter on miracles. And sometimes he kind of is in that gray area between those two propositions that you just expressed. Sometimes he's saying, well, we just can't know this stuff. And sometimes he thinks, gee, this is so ridiculous that it couldn't possibly be true. I mean, that's the example, that's the impression you get. So he kind of sometimes, especially in the chapter on miracles, he's pretty hard on miracles. And the chapter on the existence of God, it's much more a general skepticism. It's a question we can't answer. But strictly speaking, if I can speak for Hume in a more strict vein, it should just be the skeptical side. Yeah. Anything else? Well, I promised we would get to Kant, and that's where we're going right now. So let's look at Immanuel Kant. Kant tells us in his Prolegomena, one of his Prolegomena to any future metaphysics, was a work that this is funny, I think. Kant is, Marty will tell you that Kant is one of the worst writers that she's ever read. And you have a lot of company. I mean, Kant, well, I don't know. Kant was a very late bloomer. I mean, the Critique of Pure Reason came out when I think he was like 56 or something like that. Unlike Hume, who wrote the treatise at age 29 and 30. But, and I don't know if it's because he was older or if he just wasn't a very good writer. I don't know what it is. But, yeah, he will drive you crazy. And the Critique of Pure Reason is an extremely important philosophical work, but it's certainly no walk in the park. And so anyway, he wrote the Prolegomena, the one that I'm teaching a course on Kant at Ollie, and Marty's in the class. We're reading the Prolegomena. I'm not inflicting the Critique of Pure Reason on anybody. But the Prolegomena was written as a general summary of the main doctrines of the first critique. But even the Prolegomena is not exactly easygoing, although it's easier, and it's not as long as the first critique. Well, anyway, though, Kant tells us in the Prolegomena, famous sentence, he said something like, I freely admit that it was remembering what David Hume had said that woke me from my dogmatic slumber. That's the way he put it. You know, I was just sitting there, as it were, asleep in Königsberg. He was a professor at the university. But reflecting on Hume, wait a minute. This is really significant. I mean, I have said that with respect to Hume. Hume complained, a similar complaint, he when he wrote his treatise, and it sold maybe 10 copies or something like that, and he was so disappointed. And he thought, well, it was because of my style. It was too technical. So he wrote his two inquiries, parts one and three of the treatise, summarizing those two parts, to make it more popular and that sort of thing. And Hume is a much better writer than Kant. I mean, I would say he certainly succeeded in that. But the thing is, Hume was such a pioneer. And I pointed this out. I pointed this out repeatedly. Hume was such a pioneer that most people didn't understand the significance of it. And, of course, there's that foible, too. He liked to shock his readers. So most people throughout the 19th century thought of Hume as just a skeptic. That's all. In fact, Hume elicited this big reaction in Scotland. Thomas Reed, I think it was Thomas, who was the Scottish common sense realist, is the founder of a little minor school there called Scottish Common Sense Realism. Obviously, reacting to Hume as though Hume was just a skeptic, right? Well, he's not. But that's the whole deal. It was he was such a pioneer, and he was exploring such uncharted territory that it took somebody of the stature of Immanuel Kant to get it, to see what was significant about Hume. And Kant didn't even get it right off the bat. He says it's when I later went back and was reflecting on what Hume had said, and holy cow, this is really, really important. This whole idea that there is no rational basis for the belief that the future will resemble the past. He's right! So how do we account for that? So, Kant was awoken from his dogmatic slumber. And then there was this period where Kant didn't write anything. And then he came out in 1781 with the Critique of Pure Reason. One of the great works of Western philosophy.
What is the name of it again?
Critique of Pure Reason. He wrote three works beginning with the word critique of words. Critique of Pure Reason, Practical Reason, and Judgment. Those are the three critiques. And then he wrote other works that were intersected with those two in various ways. what I'm going to do is I'm going to present the same perspective that Hume presents, but now with a Kantian slant. And let me tell you, but it's not simple. And I'll tell you why in a second. But let me first of all say this. The improvement of Kant over Hume is twofold. First of all, Kant provides us with better terminology. So just as, for example, we don't use, did you know that when we do calculus, we don't use Newton's notation. We use Leibniz's. Why? It's just better. That's all. I don't know why. I'm not a mathematician. Patty probably knows, but I don't know. You know, but we use Leibniz's, not Newton's notation. Well, it's similar here. If you talk to a contemporary philosopher, you never see relations of ideas versus matters of fact, stuff like that. You don't see that. You see Kant's terms instead. So the first improvement of Kant over Hume was simply terminological, giving us a better set, and more succinct, and more bullseye, and I'll explain why shortly, bullseye-type terms than Hume had given us. That's number one. The second, and much more significant, because the first is just terminological, it's just language, semantic, but the second one is much, much more substantive, and it's this. Remember, Hume, on this third one, is not clear exactly what he wants to say about it. And I have mined out of it because I can look back 275 years later and say, oh, this is really what's significant about it. But, of course, Hume doesn't see that, as I said repeatedly. Well, Kant has a genuine theory for that third part, that third criterion, as I called it. He has a bona fide theory that is fully developed, fully self-conscious, and that sort of thing. So it's a growth based, though, on Hume's initial pioneering efforts. See what I mean? So those are the two things that we need to look at. Oh, but now the qualification. What I'm going to do is, just to save time, is to present suitably corrected Kant. Because the historical Kant is not quite so straightforward. I'll expound on that a little bit later. So, but first of all, what I want to do is show you how the suitably corrected Kant aligns with Hume. That's what I want to do. But just keep in mind, it's the suitably corrected Kant and not the historical Kant. So anyway, Kant makes two distinctions. This is the terminological half. Kant makes two distinctions, two conceptual distinctions, that are, as I say, improvements over, or that wind up being improvements over Hume's terminology. The first distinction is the distinction between analytic and synthetic propositions. And what we can say, I guess I have room over here. I can do this. What I'm going to do is do this. And let me get rid of the word positivism. Well,
I'm not there that long.
Oh, you know, the future
this has only been up
past,
for 3 weeks.
I can't get rid of it.
I know.
Oh dear.
I got the
wrong kind.
We have the spray. No, this is a regular marker. It's okay, but it really sticks, doesn't it? Well, anyway, analytic.
Isn't that the spray over there?
Get a little more off of this for a second here. Because I want to write some more.
I don't know.
There's some spray over there that may be the cleaner type spray on the left.
True. analytic as opposed to what's the opposite of analysis?
Synthesis.
Yeah, synthesis. So the opposite of analytic is synthetic. Okay. That's the first distinction that he makes. So let's look at that for just a second. All bachelors are unmarried. Hume calls that a relation of ideas, the two ideas being bachelor and unmarried. But Kant calls it an analytic proposition Why? Well, because if I analyze the concept of bachelor, what do I find in it? Oh, I find unmarried in it. It's a result of analysis of the subject of the proposition, and when I analyze the subject of the proposition, lo and behold, I find in it the predicate. So, yeah, analytic is a wonderful term for that, because that's really what's going on in my verification of the proposition that all bachelors are unmarried. Also, by the way, I keep on reminding you of this, it also underlies my falsification of the proposition there's at least one married bachelor out there. Why? Because I analyze the concept of bachelor and I find unmarried sitting there inside the box, as it were. Yeah. So the first distinction that Kant makes then is between analytic and synthetic propositions. So nowadays, if you were to talk to a philosopher about those kinds of propositions, that person wouldn't say relations of ideas. That person wouldn't bring up Hume's terminology, but rather the person would say, we're talking about analytic propositions. It's more succinct, you know, and it really gets to the heart of what's going on. What's going on is analysis. When I was at Iowa, as a matter of fact, my first year at Iowa, the chairman of the department, I think that was, yeah, he taught, it was a course on analyticity, on what it is that makes analytic propositions analytic. Now, Kant says, well, the predicate is contained in the subject. That's Kant's take on it. But there are other things you can say about it, too. Well, anyway, so that's the first distinction that he makes. So now, instead of relations of ideas, I can use the word analytic. Second distinction. Matters of fact, we have a posteriori, or its synonym, empirical, as opposed to, I put VV as opposed to a priori. I'm sure you're familiar with the term a priori. Or a synonym, pure. So the critique of pure reason, pure is used in that sense to mean a priori. The critique of pure reason, I am giving a critical assessment, doesn't necessarily mean negative, but I'm giving a critical assessment of reason used independent of the data of experience. Pure a priori, because that's what a posteriori means, or empirical. When we talk about empirical evidence, right, we are talking about data out in the world that we gather as a result of observation. We do that. And a posteriori is simply the Latin phrase that is the opposite of a priori. Posterior, in other words, to experience. So it's something that we get from experience, whereas a priori is prior to experience, something we know independent of experience, so we don't even need, like bachelors that are unmarried, we don't need to go out and do a survey or anything like that to know that that's true. So a posteriori, then, my suitably corrected Kant then says that the new term now, and once again, it's a better term because once again, it gets at the heart of where the knowledge comes from. Hume just says matters of fact. Okay, fine, that's okay, but it doesn't say anything about how I get there. But Kant says a posteriori or empirical. I get it from experience, because that's what that means. So it nicely identifies the source of the knowledge, right? And then so any proposition that's a priori is not a posteriori. That's how I define what a priori is. It's whatever is not a posteriori. And similarly, synthetic is defined in terms of analytic. Any proposition that's not analytic is synthetic.
Can I bring up Newton here?
Sure.
So let's just take Newton with all his laws of motion. I guess would be considered empirical, but his calculus, all his mathematical theorems would be pure.
Mathematics itself.
His calculus stuff.
you can plot.
Pure.
Yeah. Yeah. You can, we all know that you can investigate mathematical theorems without looking at all at the world, because it's purely conceptual. we also know there's such a thing as applied mathematics. We can apply them to the world, and that's right. And once we do that, then we're interested in the data, in the empirical data.
Okay.
Yeah.
You.
Yes.
So Kant is opposed to a priori reasoning because he wrote it's a critique of pure reason, or at least that's what I thought.
Well, he's not. No, as I say, when he says critique, it doesn't necessarily mean a negative thing. Okay, it's just a critical assessment.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
I was just trying to map that. So could you give it, and synthetic is also a problem, is that right? Could you give an example of synthetic reasoning?
Yeah. I mean, okay, well, glad you asked that because it segues me into the next thing I was going to do.
Right, sorry about that.
No, that's
good.
The check's in the mail. So I'm going to draw a matrix. This is the same matrix I drew the other day in Ollie. Because we have two distinctions of two pairs here that we've distinguished, and I can now create a 2x2 matrix of that. So I'm going to put a priori here, and I'm going to put a posteriori here. In fact, let me put pure, just so we remember, and empirical. You see the word empirical more often than you see a posteriori, but the actual term, it's opposite to a priori, it's positive. And over here I'm going to put analytic. And over here is synthetic. Okay? Now, think about my example of what Hume called a matter of fact. My example that I used the other day was all bachelors are less than 100 years old. Okay? That's an empirical proposition. It's also a synthetic proposition because I can't just analyze the concept bachelor and say less than 100 years old. Is that in that box anywhere? It's not. So remember, any synthetic proposition any proposition that is not an analytic proposition is a synthetic proposition. That's what I want to say. So all bachelors are less than 100 years old. That's not analytic because less than 100 years old is not in the box, nor is anything inconsistent with that in the box. So the only recourse I have is to go out and do a survey. That's a synthetic proposition. Any proposition, nowadays, any positivist would say that, for example, all of mathematics, this is, by the way, where the historical Kant differs from the suitably corrected Kant. I'm talking about the latter. But, positivist nowadays would say that mathematics belongs here. We know it a priori, and ultimately it's all based on unpacking concepts. Even if it takes us several steps to do that, still, ultimately it's all based on just unpacking, like our definition of triangles, a three-sided plane figure, say, that sort of thing. Working out the implications of those definitions. Now, so did I answer your question? Okay. So now, this makes it look like there are four possibilities. There really aren't. I'm going to draw an X through the one that's not really a possibility. Which one is not a real possibility?
Empirical synthetic.
No.
Because I have no idea.
Because all bachelors are unmarried is empirical, but it's also synthetic.
A priori synthetic.
What was that?
A priori synthetic.
That's right. No. That.
Do you need a?
No, that one. Okay, no, not that one.
I guess you can write.
Okay, it's this one down here. The opposite one. Analytic, a posteriori. Why? Because if it's analytic, like a bachelor's unmarried, that's my example, my standard example, and I don't need to go out and look at anything. I don't need to observe anything. I know it because I understand the meanings of the words. So and all analytic propositions are going to be like that. So it makes no sense to say that proposition X is analytic a posteriori. That's not an option, even though my boxes sort of make it look like it's an option. That's a null set. Nothing's ever going to go in here. So I X'd it out. Yes, Mike.
What about the bachelor who's married to his work?
That's using married, of course, in a different sense. Right? Yeah. We're not talking about metaphorical propositions here. But I can translate that to a literal.
Synthetic is such a strange word to use there. Was it more understood back in the day?
No, think about remember analytic. Do you think, how do you like analytic? Is that okay?
Yes.
Well, just remember, a proposition is synthetic if it's not analytic. It's just really just a negation of the opposite. Synthetic is defined in terms of analytic, mm-hmm. just as a priori is defined in terms of a posteriori.
Sorry, Don, but it's polyester that did in the term. You know, all these synthetic things.
Oh,
yeah, that's right.
I hadn't thought of that.
Blame it on polyester.
That's funny.
I find it strange too. Is the German word better? And this is directly.
No, it's actually. No, I didn't bring my book here, but it's actually analytic and synthetic in German too.
Yeah, the way we would use
it. And synthetic, but.
They right. use the same word because the other one is all Latin.
Yeah,
but
right.
But in Germany, they use a lot of Latin. Was extremely
so
important.
So analysis, right, but analysis and synthesis are actually Greek. Better words.
Mm-hmm. What was I saying? Oh, yeah, well, analytic
analysis
and synthetic
and
are... I mean, this is just the anglicization of the corresponding German right. word. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, of course, a priori and a posteriori are Latin, so...
So if I go out there and I meet a whole bunch of bachelors and I test them one after another...
You're wasting your time.
I'm wasting my time.
Because you know, because you understand the English language, they're all unmarried.
So I don't need... The idea is I don't need...
Exactly.
So it's not about whether it's testable. The point is, like, do you need a test in order to know it?
Yeah, and or in a way you've already tested it because you understand what the meaning of the word is.
100% of the time you're going to get the answer.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Why would you bother when it's always going to be 100%?
Redundant.
Yeah, yeah, it's redundant, yeah. I already know because I understand the English language, you know.
Or the German language.
Or the German, yes. So.
Which has a lot more words. They are more specific. You know, this is how normally I'm talking about different languages, and I find that, you know, in German you have one word which means just one thing,
mm-hmm.
and in English you have one word which could mean like three or four things. I said, why don't they create language which are specific for something?
Well,
and
yeah.
the Germans are very good about
it. Well, maybe so. Yeah, I mean, but of course words are, I mean, any... Just about any word you open the dictionary, you see one, two, three, and so forth and so on. So, words have many senses, that's true. And even German, they do. I don't know, I haven't done a survey to see if German is more precise. Maybe because of their tendency to cram words together to make a single
right.
word, that
and
sort of thing.
And it's exactly what it is.
Yeah,
Exactly what it is.
Okay, well, maybe so. Well, anyway, instead of saying matter relations of ideas, now we can just say matter. instead of saying relations of ideas, we can just say analytic. And yes, Jay. And instead of saying matters of fact, we can just say a posteriori or empirical. Yes, go ahead.
Analysis is like loosening
right.
up, breaking up.
Yeah, yeah.
So breaking up the.
Right, exactly. That's what it means. Yeah.
Right, yes.
And synthesis is
putting together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But when we're talking here, I think the best course of action is to say that synthetic is simply defined in terms of analytic, that it's just any proposition that's not analytic is going to wind up being synthetic.
That's very helpful, though, what he just said.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so now what I can do is I can do this. So Hume's matters of fact, relations of ideas, I mean. Okay, I can't even. Relations of ideas go here, and matters of fact go there, right? Which means, then, that Hume's CHBFI, his custom... habit, belief, feeling, instinct is synthetic a priori.
We tend to call those things emergent properties now.
Which things?
Instincts.
I don't think so. I think that the way to understand it is biological. That these are biologically rooted.
Which those usually, they're thought of as emergent properties. Of multiple cells.
Oh, okay, okay. In that sense, okay, maybe so.
Like a neural network that will, you know, has this instinct, has this idea of the future resembles the past because that's a foundational property of how neural networks even work.
Mm-hmm. When you reduce it to just the structure of the network, there's nothing about the future resembling the past in there, but when you
put
it all together, that
one input in, you get the same output.
Comes out the top, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could think of it that way if you want to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that also means I can, let's see here, this relations of ideas are going to be analytic a priori, so I'll do that. And then matters of fact, you're going to be synthetic a posteriori. Oh, shoot, I can't do that. Let's see. I'll say synthetic empirical. How's that? So I don't wind up with two SAs. That was my point. And then this one is going to be synthetic a priori, or synthetic and pure. Let's use that. Maybe instead of, I'll use pure. Pure versus empirical. Okay? So that's how things are going to line up. Now I have about 1 minute to say, and I'll obviously spend a lot more time on this next week, but to say what the second point, beyond the terminological point, right? I mean, Kant provides us with more succinct and more on-point terminology. But beyond that, remember the second big point was whereas Hume was pioneering and was not really sure what he was pioneering, Kant actually has a full-blown theory about what's going on in this third criterion. And that full-blown theory is this. What is it? Think of it biologically. What is it that's inborn? You know, exactly what's going on in the genetically inherited way in which we have to think about the world? Kant says it's a matter of organizing what comes from experience. Raw experience is a cacophony of colors and sounds and tastes and smells and the whole deal, a blooming, buzzing confusion, as William James put it once. And what the mind does, it imposes an organization, a structure on it, and thereby makes it intelligible. So when you walk into this room, or when you zoom in to this class, you don't see a billion pixels, all of which are equally important. That would be overwhelming. You see tables and chairs, you see people, you see windows, and so forth and so on. Why? Because your big brains organize all this stuff for you. And you don't even have to think about it. It's all nicely packaged and shipped up to consciousness. And there we are. So many people, so many chairs, etc., etc. It's all due to the structurations that are imposed by the human mind. That's what Hume was trying to say, but he never succeeded in bringing that to consciousness because he was a pioneer. But I, Kant, am now building a city in this new virgin territory that Hume has explored for the first time. See. Well, isn't that neat? I think it's amazing. But anyway, we're out of time. So we'll continue this next week. That's just a little sneak preview.
Bye. Yeah.